Does money make us happier?
If you look across countries, people who are better off materially are happier.
Professor John Halliwell, happiness expert.
Let me use happiness as a high value that people place on their own lives. That's the fundamental thing we measure. If you look at the countries where the highest life evaluations are given, typically the Nordic countries are all in the top 10. If you then go and drop wallets in countries, it turns out the highest rate of return is in those same countries.
How much of a contributor to happiness are meaning and purpose, do you think?
A purpose itself is probably important, but you have to...
Hey there, welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast. If you're new around here, my name is Matthew. I like to talk all things health, well-being and self-improvement every Monday and Thursday with many of the world's leading experts. If that's your thing, you're in the right place. And if you're already familiar with what I do here and would like to show your support, you can do so for free. You can like, subscribe, share with other people who you think might enjoy these episodes. You can leave the podcast a positive rating on iTunes or on Spotify. And if you're over on YouTube, you can become a subscriber over there too. Leave a comment and click that bell notification for any future videos. Now, we're all about happy habits on this podcast, and today I'm looking at happiness itself with Professor John Halliwell, who is a happiness expert. We ask what countries are the happiest and why. Are those people who are married or in a long-term relationship happier than single people? How does an experiment involving dropping wallets in the street teach us about happiness? Are younger people happier than older people? And crucially, what can we do to boost our own happiness levels? The first ever World Happiness Report was published back in 2012, and this followed on from the work by Oxford, the Royal Society and Princeton in the early noughties to begin to focus on happiness research. And then, of course, the government of Bhutan, which has been researching happiness for many years. Why research people's happiness in the first place? What value can it bring humanity from doing so?
Well, once you accept that, in fact, how people think about their lives is perhaps is an important measure of actually the quality of their life, but perhaps is the central measure of the quality of their life, then of course you have to measure it, and you have to measure it not just once, but you have to keep measuring it in different contexts so that you know if you're interested in improving people's lives, you want to know what are the life circumstances or other arrangements that make it possible for life to be better for them. So widespread measurement is absolutely central to taking it seriously. Some people have argued that you shouldn't pay attention to people's life evaluations because they're subjective and they're not actually something they have done. And of course, the answer to that is if you really are interested in the quality of people's lives, there's only one witness who's really important. And that's the person themselves. And just like with pain measurements, you can to somebody look as though they're in pain. That's all very interesting. What's really important is what they're feeling. And that's equally true with the subjective well-being. And I think gradually over the last 30 years, both statistical agencies and national governments and medical researchers are realizing that subjective assessments are extraordinarily important. And therefore, there's nothing, they're not under a gray or a black cloud saying they're suspicious. They're not. In fact, they're absolutely fundamental.
And how are these assessments carried out in order to record somebody's level of happiness in any given moment? Are they carried out in person to person? Are they carried out online? Is it a mixture of both? And how are they standardized such that the integrity of the research that is done is of the highest of standards?
People are studying subjective well-being all over the world by a variety of methods. And I'm spending most of my time dealing with the Gallup World Poll, whose data are underlying the World Happiness Reports. And in that case of that survey, There are both life evaluations and emotional reports about emotions yesterday. Did you feel them or not? Positive ones and negative ones. All are important, but the most important and central are the life evaluations. They're measured in that survey, and there are different ways of asking the question used in different surveys. But in that survey, which is the one underlying the World Happiness Report, people are asked to think about their life as a whole, with the best possible life as a 10 and the worst possible life as a 0. How would they rate their life these days? And that question is not very subject to translation difficulties. It doesn't depend on what people think happiness is, for example, and is asked in the language of the person in question. So it includes several languages in many countries with multiple languages. And it's asked by in the Gallup World Poll, it's asked of 1,000 people every year for about 150 countries. There is a literature, and an active one, thank goodness, asking whether there are cultural differences in how people use response scales, in how they think about their own lives, and so the variety of ways of teasing out whether there are such differences and whether they're important. By and large, the research we and others have done would suggest those things are sometimes relevant, and international differences in some sense are cultural differences, because there are things like national level cultural characteristics, which of course will not only influence the quality of people's lives, it'll affect what they say about them as well. And so that decomposition is complicated. But generally speaking, the response mechanisms differences are of second order importance.
So is it the case then that one cohort of humanity will see and understand happiness to mean one thing as opposed to another cohort of humanity? And that could be based on nationality, culture, race, or gender. Does happiness mean different things to different people, essentially?
Well, in a sense, what produces happiness for them? See, let me use happiness as a high value that people place on their own lives. That's the fundamental thing we measure, and it's our gold standard. We then look and see what's going on in different countries, and people in different countries get different answers, and if they do, why? And there, of course, what goes on in that society is very important. Let me give you a specific example of one thing we've discovered. If you look at the countries where the highest life evaluations are given, typically the Nordic countries are all in the top 10. If you then go and drop wallets in countries, it turns out the highest rate of return is in those same countries. Well, that's an actual behavioral experiment you can run. So that tells us these are differences that are nationally different. There was a Reader's Digest experiment more than 20 years ago, dropping wallets in cities in what were then only recently the former West Germany and the former East Germany, and they were returned much more often in West Germany than East Germany. So it shows you that even countries where they've had long shared cultures, the current political and other environments can change people's behavior. So yes, what goes on in countries differs a lot, but something like the fundamental, like other people will watch your back, which is what happens when how you feel about whether your wallet would be returned if it was dropped. It really means the people on the streets are your friends waiting to help you rather than enemies waiting to do bad things to you. So we find that when we're explaining these life evaluation differences across countries, whether you think your wallet will be returned is of extraordinary importance, even more than whether your streets are safe, whether you think yourself likely to have mental health difficulties or physical health difficulties. So So that's a cultural difference across the world, but it's measurable and it's important. And what actually drives that, what it takes to build a country where, or a society, because it doesn't have to be a national country, it can be as small as a neighborhood or as big as a world, where people do care about each other and look after each other's interests, is, of course, probably the primary question of facing humanity.
And do we know the granular reasons why the Nordic countries are more predisposed to giving somebody their wallet back? Like as you said, in Finland and Denmark and Iceland and Sweden, these are the other Nordic countries, the Scandinavian countries that are up the top of that leaderboard, that league of happy and satisfied nations. Do we know the reason for this? I know it's a cultural thing, but do we know where it stems from? And can other countries follow their lead and adapt their behavior such that they can rise up that happiness leaderboard too?
Well, one thing we tell people, although it's the rankings that bring people in, many people in to read the report to find out how their country's doing relative to other countries they think about, it's not a competitive thing. One country's happiness can go up and doesn't bring anyone else's down. And it's happiness where you live that's important. So we can indeed float all ships on a higher trust level. And of course, there are almost everything in the Nordic countries that research suggests is important for their higher things is copyable by all the rest of us quite easily. That's what's very nice about it. It really, there are lessons for individuals in that. It sort of opens your eyes to the importance of your close-in relations and care for people, not only in your circle, but outside your circle. The importance of being open and willing to reach out to other people and not to let the bustle of modern urban life or the lure of your smartphone pull you away from the possibilities to connect positively with others. Some people have suggested that, in fact, living in a difficult climate and passing through difficult circumstances together can help to build the kind of trust that returns wallets and produces happy lives. And there's some evidence from that, from responses to natural disasters, for example, where it brings people together to help each other where it does, and it raises people's expectations about the level of trust and, if you like, wallet return where they live. That in turn brings them out and makes them more likely to help others and feel better about their lives. The twist in that, this, what I think is of as crucial evidence, is that we know that the expected rate of wallet return is very important to how people feel about their lives. These experiments have also suggested to us that people are much too pessimistic about the generosity and benevolence of others. So they think their wallet will not be returned when in fact it would be returned. And of course, to solve that problem, you just have to tell people and make them believe, and that's one of the reasons the evidence is so important, that in fact, they're through the news they hear about others, you will well know from your beat on these things that there's an underlying negativity bias in people's attention. And so they're drawn to the negative things and they focus on them and they remember them more. It's held there was at one time an evolutionary reason for that, but that fast brain kind of response is outdated now, and the slow thinking brain is taking a while to catch up with the implications of that. And the implications are that you should make sure you're not being too pessimistic about your surroundings, because that will make you less happy in the first instance, but much more importantly, it'll make you less willing to reach out and help others, which in turn builds you this virtuous circle of getting to know people, which it's very hard to dislike people, you know. It's very hard to misunderstand them if you communicate directly with them. And so getting these positive circles going is very important. And so you then not only have to have the scientific evidence that people are too pessimistic, you have to then do something about it. One of the features in this year's report that was of interest to us, that we were able to split these assessments of life evaluations by age and by generation. And so we were able to find that there is a generational effect, which is typically now not been favorable. The newer generations are less happy than older ones. We also find within the younger generation a sort of decline with age, and within the older generations, increase with age. We puzzled about that. It happened in the chapter on India, which for the first time we had an Indian chapter based on a very good public health survey there, in which they found, to their surprise, I think, that every year people got older, even in a society where there were, you can't say it was all about the quality of the safety nets for the elderly and so on. That wasn't the case. The question, and then we look across countries, and we find that people who, as they get older, their self-assessed health status gets worse, a steady downward drift all the way through life for obvious reasons and more or less obvious reasons. And it matters to them more. So how could they be then getting happier? And we know that social connections are extraordinarily important for happiness. And objective measures of their own social connections with neighbors, colleagues, friends, etc., are less than of the younger groups. So how can they be happier? And psychologist Carstensen has started 25 years ago trying to explain that. And the notion is, and there's a whole lot of experiments about it, is that there is a positivity effect that is age-related, which is another way of saying once you've had a slow brain for long enough, it may start to learn relevant things. And she looks at it as people seeing the end of their life. In other words, they're into their second half of their lives and realize that. Then they think, what is it that makes a good life and what is really important? And so they stop chasing narrower material or career objectives and rethink their lives. And it leads them to pay more attention to positive things, less attention to negative things. And then that makes them happier with any given circumstance. Although their material social connections are fewer, they're more carefully curated and managed and more positively viewed. And they're then more likely to assume the better rather than the worst about other people's behavior, and then more inclined to reach out and make those connections. So despite the lesser physical health, which remains a very strong determinant, people are acquiring a positivity effect that offsets increasingly with age this underlying negativity bias. One of the open questions in that research, which we study again in Chapter 2 in this year's report, is maybe it's a problem because people's own intellectual capacities diminish with age. That's part of the declining subjective and objective health status data. And some people have less technical knowledge. And so then there has been a literature about the extent to which older people will be subject to online scamming. Talked out of their house, you name it, different. It shows up in different ways in different parts of the world. And so maybe there's a what me worry element to it, that they're happier, but they're also at greater risk, bad things happening to them. So fortunately, some researchers have said, well, that's a testable proposition, whether the positivity effect, as it were, has overridden the negativity bias and is making people too optimistic and then exposing them to bad things happening, either stepping in front of a bus or being scammed online. Well, these experimenters set up an online scam, which is easy to set up because it's coming online anyway. So you can set it up with exactly the same things burning up in the inbox or the message center or the email. An older sample and a younger sample. And they then were analyzing within these samples. Within the older sample, it's true that those with less mental capacity or less technological know-how are more likely to fall for a scam. But nonetheless, on average, and bearing in mind their lesser technical capacities to see the scams, the elderly population, the older sample, fell for the scam less often than the younger sample. So that's telling you that along with this more positive outlook, they haven't thrown away an appropriate sense of actually understanding their social environment. So it doesn't mean, because you're generally more trusting, doesn't mean you ignore evidence that suggests you shouldn't be trusting. Though in fact, this older sample, on average, looked for more evidence that this was something worth picking up rather than not, and were more insulated against. So it's saying that either the positivity effect hasn't come close to offsetting the negativity effect, or that in fact, what's being learned is not just a positive versus negative, which is a really important part of the story, but wisdom. So that's one thing that in fact your experience gives you. If you pay attention to the evidence in the right way, it doesn't mean always thinking and remembering the negatives, doesn't mean always thinking and remembering the positive. It means emphasizing the positives, but not in a way that leads you to underestimate the real riskiness of walking across the street, etc. But all this evidence is suggesting that the positivity effect so far has not come close to offsetting in a way that's bad for the people that have it or the rest of us. So that's, I think, a really important finding that came out of this age research this year. And it does say that it suggests that it feeds back into another key finding in this year's report, was that young people, especially in North America and also Australia and New Zealand and some other countries of Western Europe, are much less happy relative to the older people than they were a dozen years ago. And so, A, the question, why is this happening? And why is it happening specifically in those countries? And feeding back from our other evidence as to how important it is how you interpret the world around you for how you feel about it, is that the news feed for young people especially, both through social media and other media, and in part because the diet of things to report may be more negative in the first place, but they're still reporting them with this negativity bias. So people are bombarded with things going wrong that they should feel either guilty for in a post-colonial sense or responsible for in terms of indigenous issues or worried about in the case of gender identity issues or race relations, any number of these things, environmental degradation and so on. So all these things are in the air at a time when the younger populations are coming up. And the negativity bias would suggest that they're getting too unhappy about it. Challenges themselves shouldn't make you unhappy. Problems don't have to make you unhappy. People are actually often not more unhappy after a major crisis, included COVID, where life evaluation skated through because it enabled people to see the best of others. It brought out high benevolence, as we could see. The same thing could be happening with respect to the problems that are facing all of us now, nationally and internationally. But this particular group of English-speaking young people is apparently getting a negative spiral in its news feed and what they think about it. And it's been created only in the last 10 to 15 years. So as it came quickly, it can be turned around equally quickly. It's not fundamental to humanity, and it hasn't happened everywhere. Some evidence of why that is was exposed after the report went to press, but before we actually released it, we were asked by a major French language newspaper, La Presse in Canada, how this result played out, how our data played out in Quebec. And we discovered that this big drop in youth well-being in the United States was only half as big in Quebec as in the rest of Canada. And that suggests that the language in which this is happening, or the cultural norms that go with language, in fact, is a central part of this story.
Very interesting. So if we can move then from negative biases to meaning and purpose, I know Aristotle has spoken about this before, and I know you're an admirer of Aristotle, having quoted him in some of your speeches in the past. How much of a contributor to happiness are meaning and purpose, do you think?
A lot, for sure. Both everybody who looks deeply into this topic has found that expressed in different ways. It has to be something that's engaging, appropriate. And a better purpose is more effective than a worse purpose. You can have evil purposes as well as good purposes. A purpose itself is probably important, but you have to believe in it, and it'll be much more effective if it's one with positive spillovers to other people. I think, by and large, the research suggests that. How much of the total story it is, that's always difficult to break these things down on in detail, because most of the surveys we've been using over the years do not have a purpose question in them. So we don't know its relative importance. There are some new surveys that do, but it's got to be part of this story. It's what you believe about the world in which you live and your own position in that world. And so you want to feel happy about being there, and you want to feel happy about your own contributions to that. And that was clearly a very important part of Aristotle's set of hypotheses. In fact, there are some people who even list purpose and things like purpose, and they call it eudaimonic well-being, using Aristotle's word for happiness. Well, that's overreach. Eudaimonia is really the whole science of happiness, in which purpose, as Aristotle said, is fundamental, but it's by no means the whole story. And it deserves its due role, which is an important one. And it's increasingly getting it.
Can I ask a definitive question here and get the definitive answer from you, given that you're a happiness expert? Does money make us happier?
What makes you happier is being able, money itself, typically not. There are some nice studies being done in societies that essentially have no monetization at all. They turn out to be just as happy as in highly monetized societies. I mean, these are hunter-gatherers societies, so you can say, no, you can be as happy as anybody else without any monetized commercial society at all. Yes, you could imagine that. Why shouldn't that be true? If we're all producing things and sharing them, we don't have to have done it in a buy and sell market in order to convince ourselves that we have enough for ourselves and enough to look after each other and the people we care about. Empirically, if you look across countries and within countries, people who are better off materially are happier. The question then is, there's a chicken and egg question. So the more you then model happiness in terms of the things that money can't buy but is often associated with. So, for example, you have richer societies are more able to provide broad and effective health care and education. And when they do so, it produces happiness. A more effective for all health and education system gets you more equality of happiness, and people are happier in an equal society of happiness. The problem with emphasizing the role of money, I mean, you wanted a definitive answer. The answer is, for all the, if you add some measure of the ability of either a society or a household to command goods and services, to look after themselves, does that attract a positive effect? Yes, almost everywhere. In many cases, very small. And that's the really important thing about it. The question is, how is it in size and importance relative to all the other things that people have long ignored? And so for a mixture of reasons, people, both in the development field and in the personal advice field, have tended to emphasize material rewards over and material causes of happiness relative to the other things. And it then leads people to make Faustian bargains in their own lives. So taking a job with more stress, far away, unpleasant circumstances, in order to have more income, and leaving themselves, and they find in a puzzling way less happy than they would have been had they focused more on it. And it's true of all aspects of life, how you choosing your people you associate with, choosing an employer where the workforce is happy rather than highly paid. That turns out to be the actual monetary equivalent of a happy workplace is huge. And that's because the social determinants of happiness are more important than the purely material ones. So it's the dominance of the social over the material that needs more emphasis, obviously. That's underlying the kind of discussions you see. It's not clear to me why, as the science of well-being has evolved, there still is so much attention on how much does money matter, as though that income were as the be-all and end-all, and it never was and it never should have been, and the evidence suggests it never is. There's often then talk about how high does your income have to be before you start skidding. That's a very unproductive literature, because the effects they're looking at are not very big in the first place and depend on which measure of well-being you use and so on. So there are lots of this discussion about what is a sufficient level of income. Well, as you might imagine, when you think of the complexities of life, what is a sufficient income depends a whole lot on the kind of society you're living in and what the values are and what the norms are and whether they think we're all in this together or this is a winner-takes-all society where what matters is whether you have a Lamborghini or not. And clearly the societies that think what matters is whether you have a Lamborghini or not are not going to be happier societies. There was an interesting study in Switzerland where they looked at the differences. Switzerland, of course, has been number one in the rankings. And they looked across cantons in Switzerland about the density of Lamborghini ownership, and it was a strong negative relation. And the more Lamborghinis there were in your canton, the lower your average life evaluation. That's telling you that materialism, and especially flaunted materialism, has negative spillovers, right? I mean, other people are either going to be cross with you for misusing the world's resources or envious of you for having them. In either event, it's not good news.
And I suppose any discussion of money and happiness has to factor in the hedonic treadmill theory, which further complicates things.
It does. And you could think that that a treadmill could come about simply because something wasn't important, but you thought it was. So you get it. And then you find out it hasn't worked. So I said, maybe I need more. Well, that could put you on a treadmill. So that treadmill is just one you want to get off. There's another more subtle treadmill that can apply over the centuries. And this comes back to some of the underlying discussions about what's underlying this so-called Easterlin effect, where a lot of countries have had increases in a number of the key supports for well-being without their average reported well-being rising very much. And part of that is, in some sense, a happiness treadmill, but you can think of it as just being a way of making progress and not making progress, or moving in a direction without making real progress. There's another way of thinking about it, that these questions ask you how satisfied are you with your life, or they say, or can be relative to the best possible, or just how satisfied are you. But as life has improved over the centuries, which by most of the key measures it has, lifespan, average health, frequency of killing diseases, and so on, has risen over the centuries. And in many societies now, people don't consider among the possibilities some of the things that were key realities centuries ago. So your view of the menu, what's possible, gets better every year, and that's a good thing. And that, to the extent it changes your use of the best possible life and worst possible life scale, you're not losing it. It's just banked. It's saying, okay, we've made those progresses in our ability to not murder each other, to not have ourselves children die at birth, and so on. And that's done. We're not going to go back. So we redefine our scale. And that's another version of, you could think of it as a hedonic treadmill. And it just means that you bank progress to date and then try and make further progress. There are people who argue a slightly different aspect to this. Amartya Sen was against the use of these subjective well-being data because he said you go into the terribly badly off countries in Africa with very little access to the basic supports for good life, what he called the capabilities. And they'll look at them, they'll tell you they're happy. The flaw in his argument was he just assumed they'd tell you they were happy. They are happy, but it's happy given their circumstances. Nobody should be unhappy about the circumstances they're living in beyond what they have to be. The happiness you see in these very impoverished and unhealthy societies is that people are making the best of what they have, and they're enjoying each other's company. They're helping each other. And of course, that makes them happy. And of course, the smile is a good thing to face the world with, whatever your circumstances are like. So he thought these measures, if you asked them, that in the really badly off countries, in human terms, his capability terms, would give you high answers, and that would be wrong. And his reasoning was they don't know what they're missing. You know, they don't know what life could have been like, so they're satisfied with what they have. But of course, what our data show dramatically is that's not true. In those places where capabilities are low, where life opportunities are low, despite the fact they're making the best of it, and you see lots of smiles and happiness in this emotional sense of happiness, and you ask them to evaluate their lives, they're right there down at the twos and the threes and the fours on a scale of 10. They understand that much better is possible. It's telling you that people are capable of valuing their lives in a realistic way.
Would you agree with some of my research findings in that people who are married or in a long-term relationship are happier, and people who are single and more predisposed to being isolated or lonely are unhappier? Would you find that in your experience?
Well, that turns out to be something I spend a lot of time because one of the fundamental complaints, or at least patterns of thought in psychology, has been the so-called set point theory, that everybody's got their own base level of happiness. Getting married or anything, winning a lottery or anything like that, can drive you off that set point for a while, and then you'll go back to where you were before. Well, if that's true, then it's silly to use measures of subjective well-being as measures of national progress, or even progress across different population groups within the country. And so there were studies showing that people, when they got married, they got happier, but then they came back down to their base level. This is in the context of surveys following the same people through time. And fortunately, some researchers were then able to say, well, wait a minute, these are people tending to get married in their 20s and 30s are at a time when, on average, the population is getting less happy. So the married person, if they go up happier, and they get happier when they get married and drop to a level where they were before they got married, who you want to compare them with is the person who started out as the same age but didn't get married, and they're getting less happy. So in fact, that happiness preference for the married stayed there. There was another argument against this finding that people who are married are happier, and that is that happier people are more likely to attract spouses and to get married. So the causality going the other way around, a simple correlation between marriage and happiness, it's the happy people are getting married, not that the marriage itself is making people happier. So we went into a big UK longitudinal survey, and we put in people's initial level of happiness before they entered the relationship. And that looks after the reverse causality. And in fact, it turns out to explain about a quarter of it. So it isn't as though it is a real finding that happier people are more likely to find and mates and marry. But the more important effect is the one coming back from the marriage. We find that it's not just the institution of marriage, that living alone kind of arrangements typically are up in two-thirds or three-quarters that the same effect. And especially important, and it speaks to your linking of the social context of different kind of family units and their happiness, that there was a British survey where in one survey they, of course, found out how happy they were and they found their marital relations. And another part of the survey, they said, who is your best friend? And then they listed a number of alternatives. And one of the alternatives is my spouse. And it turns out the benefits of marriage were twice as big for the people who also regarded their spouse as their best friend, which means these things are linked closely together. Because after all, a spouse is someone you're spending a great deal of time with. And if they're also someone whom you are attracted to, not just in that sort of normal marriage procreation senses, but actually you respect them and enjoy their company and treat them right up there with your top friends, then that's going to be important. So if you then have that combination of a close personal relation with actually is not just a marriage type relationship, but also a core part of your friendship, that's going to make you happier. Married people rely less on their non-partner friends for happiness than others, but it's still very important to them. So they're positive spillovers of both.
It's interesting that time and time again, the one thing that keeps coming back to being a key ingredient to finding happiness is that social aspect, that pro-social aspect again and again, which I suppose makes sense because we are social creatures.
Precisely that. And what has been, I don't think, focused on enough, and even Aristotle, I think, did not. It was in the small print rather than the big conclusions. Maybe part of it is the good life and purpose, but essentially doing things for others, pro-social activity, because it turns out that's extraordinarily important. And once you understand that, then it means you don't, when you're thinking as a society, how do we increase the possibilities that we will all act in the general interest? Most of the levers of democratic governments are regulations and financial incentives. And once you understand the mechanics of human happiness, you say, no, that's not what it's about. What it's about is setting up a system in which people have the opportunities to help each other. And so you get many, many win-win circumstances that are lost if you think you have to buy good performance or regulate it. You don't. What you have to do is enable people to unlock this basic human capacity and need for helping each other. As you say, it is a fundamental feature of the evolution of humanity in communities. And the successful communities had it and the unsuccessful ones didn't. So there is a community level a survival power to working together in cooperation. And from time to time in different societies, that's been lost. It's sometimes been focused because you sometimes can create unity within by having an enemy without the gate. But that's a dangerous game to play as the world gets more connected because nobody's outside the gate these days for long. So you have to have a broader, what we call social identity, so that if humanity to survive happily has to take these essential pro-social instincts and spread them over a wider ambit. It's not just your family and friends and small in community. It's the broader community and indeed future generations of humans and others wherever they may live. And that takes some time. There's a sense in which the technology linking people has expanded faster than our understanding and social connection with people different than ourselves. And so you're still learning the question, learning the skills of understanding and treating as part of the bigger us, people who are really quite different from ourselves. The negativity bias comes in and tries to stop you from doing that by creating the others as negative. The robbers' cave experiments, there's a whole range of stuff building on that, showing indeed you can make out-groups and make people do bad things for out-groups. But if you give them an even-handed opportunity to create in-groups, i.e. we're all in this together, they'll end up being happier.
It's such an interesting subject, and I think one that really requires more attention. And I know you've been trying to shine a light on this for many, many years. Professor, if people want to find out more about this happiness research, where can they go online?
Well, I think the first place to start would be the World Happiness Report. It's all the World Happiness Reports are now 12 of them are online. There's separate issues covered each year. And as we discussed, happiness at different ages was a key part of this year's report. We've looked at migration. We've looked at the environment. We've looked at the neuroscience. There are a whole set of aspects that are really important. And so you don't just read one report, you read a bunch of them with breaks in between to go for a walk with your neighbor.
Well, thank you so much. We will pop a link to that report in the show notes for this episode. But for the moment, Professor John Helliwell, thank you so much for giving me so much of your time today.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, and especially someone who's studied these things as carefully as you have.
Well, thank you for tuning into this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. Hopefully you enjoyed it. And if you did, or indeed any of the previous 400 plus episodes, show your support. It's free. You can like, subscribe, share with other people who you think might get value from these episodes too. You can also leave the podcast a positive rating on iTunes and on Spotify. And if you're over on YouTube, become a subscriber there. You can also leave a comment and click that bell notification for any future videos. Until next time. Stay happy.